On this episode of the People Stack podcast, Rob and I interviewed Jason Silver. He is a startup advisor, and he is in the process of very soon launching a book called Quietly Crushing It, Unlock Big Impact at Work Without the Burnout in Life. So he has experience in tech. He has experience with finding your joy, following your joy without burning out. So as you can probably imagine, we talked about a bunch of fun topics that are all absolutely aligned with what we're about at the People Stack. And I know what you're about as a technical leader who wants more out of your career. We talked about enjoying your work more and how actually enjoying your work is going to help you have even more of an impact, not less, that actually you can work less to have more of an impact. We unpacked all of that. We talked about agency, having personal power, having personal sovereignty. That was one of the underlying themes of the entire conversation. How do I bring agency? How do I bring personal power to my decisions as a leader, my decisions about the business that I work for? He also said something that I absolutely loved. I loved it so much, I wish I said it. He said, dream jobs are a practice. They're not something that you win. So a lot of people think, oh, dream job, it's like I won my dream job, like I won the lottery. No, you are practicing your dream job right now or you're not. So if you don't have your dream job right now, check in on your actions, check in on your intentions. We talked about actions versus intentions. We talked about feedback, bringing agency to the seeking and receiving of feedback. We talked a whole bunch about decision-making, and he revealed a decision-making heuristic that, like, if you just change this one thing in decision-making, it's going to be way easier and way more fun too. We talked about persuading, how to persuade people to change their mindset. And we talked about action, taking the importance of taking action and the importance of gratitude, the importance of creating a mindset and a home of gratitude. So this was a multi-layered conversation, as is usual in our conversations. It was also an assumption challenging conversation. I know that it's going to challenge some of your assumptions about how to live your best life, how to do your best at work, how to make the most impact in your career as a leader. I know it's going to challenge some of your assumptions. It even challenged some of ours. So enjoy and please extract value from this fabulous conversation. Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. We are super excited today to interview Jason Silver. He is a startup advisor, and he's also authored a book called Quietly Crushing It, Unlock Big Impact at Work Without the Burnout in Life. And that is going to be available summer 2024. Is that right, Jason?
Yep. Counting down the
days. Awesome. Awesome. So we have a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Lots of overlap. So let's start with your career. So you're a startup advisor now. I know that's not what you've always done. And then there's the whole book thing as well. So we're excited to dive in and find out the fun paths and the fun long and winding road that led you to where you are right now. So yeah, take it from there.
Cool. Thanks a ton for having me. First of all, it's great to get a chance to chat. And it's definitely been a winding road. Always fun to kind of look back and try to make sense of the path that didn't feel like it made any sense leading up to the moment. But just to give you the high level sense, you asked career, but I've got two kids. They're pretty important to me. They're 6 and 3. Both of them are boys. They keep us incredibly, incredibly busy. That's where a lot of the mental energy and physical energy seems to be going these days. In terms of the career arc, originally an engineer by training, I did a master's in electrical and computer engineering. Thought that I was going to spend all of my career on the technical stuff. Learned pretty quickly that I was really, really interested in how you build a great team around a really good initial idea. And so I got very interested in business. I founded two of my own companies. I helped grow another one in the artificial intelligence space in its earlier days, back before it was like the cool thing to do. Also very lucky to be one of the earlier on employees at Airbnb. We weren't in the startup stage then, more of the scale up, but got to feel what the classic Valley unicorn looked like of, you know, hundreds of people going up to many, many thousands of people. I've crashed a startup before, so I've gotten to experience like, you know, the complete opposite of conventional success, as well as kind of the unmitigated up and to the right as fast as you can possibly scale success and what that's like. Now I work with a lot of different executives at different companies, really helping them build their companies. I do a lot of the traditional strategy stuff, but I sneak in a lot of like, how do you actually enjoy the process of building a company, which can be very stressful? Like, how do you enjoy it? Not just for yourself, but so you create an environment that people actually really want to work at, you know, not just like grinding their way through. As you mentioned, I'm writing this book, Quietly Crushing It. It's super exciting. I never thought I was going to write a book before, but, you know, here we are, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit today. But the whole idea is, as you mentioned, bigger impact at work with less burnout in life. And it's not about work-life balance as much as it's about transforming work, which is where we spend so much of our energy, from a drain to one of the biggest drivers in what makes you feel great in your life overall. Launched a newsletter, which is another thing I've never done before, to kind of support the book, where I share tactics every other week to help people do and feel better at work. And also a very terrible dad joke, because I find them really funny, even though most people don't. And that's kind of, there's the arc. Let's see where it goes from there.
Awesome. So there's lots of different threads we can potentially pull at here. So the one I'm going to pull at first is, what made you decide to write a book? Because you said it's not something that it wasn't like a childhood dream, is what I'm going to assume.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was something that was like, hey, yeah, I guess I'm doing this. So what's the motivation? What's your why around writing the book?
Yeah, I guess if I was to rewind the tape a little bit, when I was at the last company I was helping to build, I had this moment where I realized that I was missing a very key portion of what I've since learned is my mission statement, which is to help people enjoy doing hard things. And I was very focused on helping people do hard things and doing really hard things, but I realized I kind of lost the joy of it. Like, I was doing them because they were hard. I wasn't really enjoying. I was just like, you know, the word I guess he would use is like grinding it out, basically. And when I got really focused on enjoying doing the hard things, I turned the kind of startup product manager test and learn mentality from, you know, building a product to like my life. You know, what are all the assumptions I have about work? How could I actually enjoy work better? How could I turn work from this thing that's making me feel drained at the end of every day to something that makes me feel like really fired up, both going to and leaving at the end of every day? And the more I experimented, the more I learned that there are all these assumptions about how we're working that really didn't bear out when I really put them underneath the microscope. A lot of things I was doing because my ego told me I had to do it a certain way, or other people told me I had to do it a certain way. And as I started to see myself feeling better and doing better, honestly, I was shocked that like the more I enjoyed it, the better I did. I don't know why that was shocking, but it was. As that really started to kick up, folks on my team started to take notice, and they were asking questions, and I started sharing with them. And I got so passionate about it, I said, hey, I want to go and focus all my energy on it. And that's when I decided to step back. It was a tough choice. Like, I really love the company I was working with, love the team, but I really wanted to just focus on, like, how do I help people do this very specific thing? And as I work with more and more folks now in more of an advisory capacity, where yes, we talk about a lot of strategic stuff, but I use it as kind of the Trojan horse to how do you make the experience better as well? The more I did that, the more I was getting feedback from clients that, Jay, nobody is like talking about this kind of stuff. It's the same problems we've heard people mention before, but nobody has the same outlook on the problem. We haven't heard these solutions that you're talking about, the tactics that you're walking us through. Like, you got to write them down. Nope, I'm not an author. That's not a thing I want to do. Push back until one day I said, what the heck, let's just try. And I wrote, in quotations, a chapter. I wrote a thing. And again, I just treated it like a startup where I wrote a chapter. I wanted to see how it would feel. And I sent it around to a bunch of people to see what they would think. And the feedback was great. Not, hey, this is the best thing we've ever read. It was like, hey, here's some stuff that is very helpful. And also, here's a bunch of stuff that's really not good. You could do a better job at it. And that just led to honing my process a little bit, writing another chapter. It honestly snowballed on me. It probably wasn't until I was roughly halfway through the book that I realized and would actually say out loud, hey, I'm writing a book. It took me until probably the end of the process where now I'm very fortunate, you know, the manuscript's in place. I'm working with one of the editors from Atomic Habits, which is a book I really, really enjoyed as well. So getting to work with someone who touched that project is really great. And now looking backwards, when I hear someone like you say, well, you wrote a book or you're writing a book, how did you decide? You know, it's one of these things where I was just focused on doing what I was enjoying and what was, you know, feeling like it was impactful for folks. And it snowballed into all of a sudden now I've got a book. It's a crazy amount of work. But yeah, I wouldn't say there was an intentional moment where I was like, okay, I'm going to write a book. It was, well, I guess I've written this much of a book. We might as well finish it now.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Oh man, it's also very inspiring because I think for a lot of people, there might be this, oh, maybe I'll write a book or maybe I won't or whatever it is. And it's just like, you know what? Follow what's fun and follow what you enjoy. And so let's talk about that. Let's talk about enjoying work, especially in the startup world. I love the title, Quietly Crushing It. That was one of the reasons you had contacted me, so that everybody knows, you know, out there who's listening, we met on the RANS Leadership Slack. So highly recommend the RANS Leadership Slack, folks. We'll put a link in the show notes for how to join. But Jason reached out to me and then I was like, oh, wow, quietly crushing it. Like, that's a lot of our clients. Like, we don't use those words, but a lot of the people who we work with and are drawn to working with us are quietly crushing it. It's like, you know, I don't need to be like in your face or anything like that, but like, I want to be in the background doing these cool things. And people look at me like, wow, I should do it. And so I actually love that little magic trick myself as well. It's like, you know, because a lot of people ask us, you know, like, you have a son, you're traveling the world, you lived in Hawaii. How are you even making this work? Sometimes, you know, some days I can't even, you know, function. I can't even remember to pour my coffee or whatever.
I got a lot of days like that.
I think we do all have days like that. And I think that that's part of the process of understanding it. And then underneath that, it's okay, I'm quietly crushing it. I'm coming to a question if you'll just let me.
I'm excited for it.
Just a little bit. Yeah. Because the other thing that I want to kind of tie in here is the startup world, right? So the startup world is, there's, perhaps it's overblown, but I've certainly seen startups where people are completely stressed out, burned out, and it's just like, I'll sleep when I'm dead, grind it, crush it. And there's not really any kind of focus on balance or self-care or enjoyment. It's just, let's just do it. Let's do this already. So I'm curious how you're approaching this in a world where there might be this strong tendency toward burnout, toward work,
toward grit and grind, and I need to work really hard to get results. And what you're saying is actually enjoy it more and you're going to get better results. So what is the approach look like when you're consulting, when you're advising companies like that?
Yeah, that's why I mentioned it's a bit of a sneak attack sometimes. You know, you got to give your kids vegetables and you make them like zucchini brownies. You know, you can't quite tell that you're taking the medicine, but you are. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I think it should always be disguised, but I do think that it has the idea of it has a bit of it leaves a bit of a bad taste in your mouth. And it did for me as well at first. Because the thought I had, what I associated with is, okay, great. If I'm going to enjoy it more, what that means is I have to have less impact, right? And the only way to like slow myself down, if I'm not to use your words, like if I'm not running at 100 miles an hour and just like grinding, I have to accept less by turning down the volume. Therefore, I'm going to deliver less. And that's going to be how I'm going to enjoy it. The problem that I experienced, I can label myself as a type A, and I won't, you know, guess for other folks, but the problem that I experienced was like, that was not an okay trait. I was not okay with the idea of like, well, I'll just try less hard and do less, and that will feel better for me. Because I constantly would have this concern of, well, I could be doing more. Why am I not doing more? And I never quite resonated with that idea. What I did really like is the idea of, you know, you want to work smarter, not harder. The problem with that is, what the hell does that actually mean? Like, I've heard that expression 1,000 times. People have told it to me. I've said it to other folks. And it's like, well, what do I do with this? You know, I don't know how to, I'm not waking up every morning and saying, hey, I'm going to go and do this thing I have to do today in the dumbest possible way that I can come up with. It'll be great. No, you're doing it in the way that you think is the best, is the smartest, by looking at people around you and seeing what they're doing and trying. And, you know, what I found actually through my own experimentation and working with other folks is you can have way more impact because you're enjoying it more. And when you treat that as the incoming hypothesis and running experiments to look for ways to do that, then you find them. But it's only when you explicitly look for those things. And it kind of breaks down into three big buckets for me. That is not shockingly how I structured the book. But the first is, you know, how can you do 5 days of work in 4 without working until midnight? And so this is all about the efficiency stuff. There's just a bunch of inefficiencies in the way that we work, particularly on teams, where it's costing us like a day every week because of some kind of inefficiency that's going on. And all you have to do is remove that, and all of that frustration and unnecessary work goes away, and you have exactly the same amount of impact. Now you have a full day left over and you can make a choice. Hey, I'm going to work a 4-day week and have the exact same amount of impact. That's great. Maybe you want to work a 5-day week and you take this other now brand new fresh day and you do more stuff in it. And now you're having more impact, right, with the exact same amount of effort that you used to be putting in previously. And then once you get that done and you figure out how to be a little bit more efficient in the office, how can you enjoy your day-to-day more without changing your job? There's just a lot of rhetoric out there that I need to be on a different team. I need to be in a different role. I need to work on a different project. I need to quit this job and get another job. That's the only way I'm going to enjoy it more. It's true that sometimes that is the case, but in my experience, that is the minority. Like that's the exception, not the rule. The rule itself is you have a lot of agency in your job, usually more than you think you do, to change the way that you're actually working day to day and enjoy it a heck of a lot more. And then the final one is, how am I going to progress faster without waiting for a promotion? A lot of people feel like, hey, I really want to move up. I want to grow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there's not a lot of opportunity here for me. And usually that means I have a boss and there's only one boss whose job I could have. And because they're there, there's not really somewhere I can go. Particularly for folks that might be listeners of this podcast who are probably technical leaders, they're starting to bump up against the top levels of the hierarchy. And so the question is, how do you progress without needing a promotion? You definitely don't, in my humble opinion, but how can you break those things down? And when you add those three up, how do we work more efficiently? How do we enjoy the day-to-day more? And how do you progress faster without waiting around for a promotion? These are the things that add up to, oh my gosh, I'm working way smarter now, not any harder. And these are the things where I look for avenues in to help folks see some of these things and then bring in the hey, look at this, more impact and you're enjoying it more. Let's go find more of this like really great low hanging fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. So one more question on this thread for now, and then I'm going to kick it over to Rob because I'm curious what he's thinking. So I'm sort of framing this question. I'm imagining people listening, and our listeners, our potential clients, our clients, I know them, I have a feel for them. So what I'm imagining is someone saying, all right, this sounds great, Jason, but, and then just insert whatever it is. It won't work for me. There's no way. I have 5 kids. I don't have enough. I don't know. Maybe it's money that's getting in the way. There's some hurdle. Or there's no way that my boss would allow me to work for 4 days. Or I'm just too scatterbrained or whatever it might be. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about what are some of the biggest objections that you find? And then if you can give us kind of like a case study of someone who's overcome those objections, I think that would be really inspiring.
Okay, cool. So biggest objections and case study of somebody overcoming an objection. I think to just put the disclaimer up front, which is hopefully not detractive from the message, hopefully it's beneficial, because I'm not a big believer of, you know, one size fits all solutions. And for me to sit here and say, hey, if you have a problem, I have the solution, no matter what your problem is, I just have this one solution, it's going to be great, I think would be very disingenuous. My experience is that, you know, I've been very lucky to work on a lot of incredible teams with a lot of incredible people, and now with a bunch of really great companies and their executives. And I see these things work over and over and over again. I do think that if you were to look at the Venn diagram, like there is an area where there isn't overlap, I do think it's a valid pushback, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And that's if you're in a situation where, first of all, I mainly focus on folks who are knowledge workers. I think most people who are listening to this podcast fit into that bucket. If you work in a factory, that is very foreign to me. And I would love for some of my tactics to be beneficial in that area, but I can provide zero evidence for that. And the other is there are very challenging workplace situations out there where sometimes you don't have the agency to make the change. And that can be because, you know, you're living paycheck to paycheck, and any amount of risk or push on your role is not something that you're prepared to take on. And you know, that you do have to be careful in situations like that. There are folks who can be very oppressive in the way that they manage their teams, who certainly can lock folks down, and that might be very challenging to work with. I think what I try to get people to understand is, you know, a lot of us are very fortunate to not be in that situation. And it might feel like we are at times, and you need a bit of a perspective shift to recognize that you're not in a situation like that. More often than not, we have a lot more agency than we think we have. There is a lot more inefficiency going on around us than you think there might be. And so the way that I tend to get past the biggest objections is usually with a very test and learn methodology. I think what I've really tried to develop over time is, you know, I've never been a big fan of books or advice that is like very, very either philosophical, convoluted, too many steps, too much breakdown. I think momentum is so unbelievably important. You know, you're in state A today, you're trying to get to state B. Maybe we're not going to go from A to B immediately, but we want to go from like A to A prime so that you can at least see that like the trend line's going where we want to go. So what is the lowest, the smallest possible unit that we can work on to then let you see that there's a step you can take and see some benefit? And once you see benefit, then you're going to dive in more, and you're going to kind of keep going along the way. You asked for a case study, which is interesting because it's hard for me to pick one in a vacuum, but I think one area that is maybe going to be helpful for this chat is something that I work on with a lot of folks, and we can dive into this more deeply if you want. But I work with a lot of leaders on, let's say, org structure is maybe the most agreed upon, like highest level concept. Now, that sounds like a very tactical conversation, and it is in a lot of ways, but I like to start folks on what do you want to be working on? How do you want to show up for work? What are you great at? And how do we think about the person that you want to be at work and then build a team around that, and then build an org structure around that. And oftentimes what I'll get pushback on up front before we've gone all the way through, I was working with a technical leader recently with something like this. He had done so much great work to ask around about other people's technical organizations. And the assumption was, because I'm thinking about something like this, it looks like a lemon and theirs look like, I don't know, apples, right? I'm therefore doing it wrong. And it was a little bit of time to unwind it and say, wait a minute. Like, if you're going to do the best job possible with lemons, I don't care that their team is apples. This is feeling like a really weird analogy, but I guess just stick with me. Hopefully people are still following. Right. But the whole idea is having the courage to build your team your way with what you're great at and what you want to be focused on. And it's not selfish. It's smart. You know, of course, if all you want to do is sit with your feet up, you know, having a Mai Tai on the beach, probably this job is not the right job for you. By the kinds of things that I mean, you know, as a technical leader, maybe you really do like going deep and getting into the code. Maybe you don't like that at all. Maybe you like doing a lot more longer term vision stuff with where the product's going to go, or you're really interested in how the team's going to adopt AI tools to really speed up our development cadence, whatever it might be, right? You're going to take your time and pile it into there, which is going to leave some vacuums. And how are we going to build a team around you such that you get to focus the time and energy on the things that are the highest leverage for you, most important for the company, et cetera, and still have the team getting what they need, even though it's not necessarily going to come from you. Oftentimes I see that the org structure conversation comes through the lens of, well, this is how it should look. We got to have a CTO and then these VPs and then these directors and then this underneath that. And so I really like to start with, well, hang on a second. Where are you on this? What are you interested in? And we can talk through an exercise I run folks through to help them figure this out. What are you interested in? And now how do we build a great team around the best version of yourself in this company that we can go and do? And once that happens, the org chart, it's not that it's simple, but it tends to fall out of that. And this particular tech exec restructured the org and like is flying now, you know, loves it, happy about it. Folks on his team are like, they just got new stuff that they weren't on before because this leader was doing that stuff. He's now handed it off. They love it because it's new responsibility for them. He loves it because it's responsibility that's come off his plate to focus on other things. And that's an example where, you know, we work on the system and the system enables you to be the version of yourself that you want to be.
Love it. Love it. That is an awesome example. Thank you for that. Thank you for digging, despite being in the vacuum. Thank you for finding that golden nugget there. That's awesome.
Yeah, lemons Rob, and apples.
Yeah. So Rob, where do you want to go with this?
So I got this lemon and
that's funny. He's holding a lemon right now for people who are.
Yeah, not on camera. So I love this because it lets us talk about sort of the executive level for a bit. In my work, in my travels, I have a couple of core beliefs that are kind of central to how I look at a bunch of things. And it sounds like we've got alignment here. So I want to dive deeper into it. But the first and foremost is that software and technology in general exists predominantly to solve a real human problem. So we take that as a given. That's what the company is structured around. When it comes to the organizational leadership, I also see the CTO and the VPs as being a symbiotic partnership type of arrangement. When you think about how someone would be coming up through different organizations, how do you feel about somebody who wants to only be people or who wants to only be technical or who wants to have impact without taking on that myriad of the whole matrix of types of responsibilities? Do they need to find the right partner for VP CTO, or do they need to grow in those areas? Long way of asking that.
No,
I got stuck with the lemon.
Plus you held up the lemon, which is shocking because this was like, my brain was going 100 miles an hour thinking, how do I come up with some silly analogy so I don't talk accidentally about some specifics of this company? And luckily they're not a lemon or apple farm, and that you had a lemon was pretty funny. But I think the question was, okay, I'm coming up through the leadership organization. I can focus on, you know, maybe being more deep on the technical side. Maybe it's more focused on leadership. Like, do I grow into those? Do I build a team around myself for those? How do I make that kind of a decision? Did I get that right?
Yes. And how do I look to augment the parts of myself that are not fully formed or not ready for upper tier with the right partnerships throughout the organization?
Okay, cool. So this is another one of these where answering this question in generalities, I think is really tough, because the answer is like yes and yes, or both, or, you know, all, which is exceedingly unhelpful for people, because it is quite context dependent. I think, again, disclaimer up front, like, there will be certain business realities, you know, and you are sometimes in a situation where we need this thing done. You have capacity. Maybe you even have capability. That would be extra nice. You might not like this thing. Sometimes we just have to do it. We can't hire someone. We can't shuffle somebody around. Again, my experience is that if you're truly dedicated to trying to like solve this problem, and by this problem, I mean putting the best people on the right things in the right ways for them and the company, it is usually a solvable problem. I find more often than not, we cop out before we get to the solution, because it is not usually the easiest solution or the first solution that we think about. It often takes a little bit more work. We've got to move Rob over to here and Jen over to there so Jay can go over to here, versus we'll just plug Jay over here and he can do those things that Jen and Rob are going to do. So the first thing is, yeah, in some situations, there's not going to be flexibility, but figuring that out is kind of step one, and really testing your assumptions of, do I have to take this on? Is there someone else that can do this? These aren't, you know, bad teamwork questions. These are great teamwork questions. It's not you being a terrible team player. It's you actually thinking, is there somebody better suited than I am to take this particular thing on? Either because they're better at it than I am, or because I'm better at something else, or that other folks can't do. And if I focus on this thing, I can't go do that other thing that needs to uniquely be me, or is going to benefit the most from being me. So I think just really testing the assumption up front is really important. And then I would start with like the intention layer. Like, what do you want? And I'll give you an exercise that everybody can do for fun. And not only we'll do it on the podcast, but folks will be able to follow. It's really super simple. And so the idea I like people to think about here is, as leaders inside of companies, I find we spend almost all, if not all of our time, thinking about, talking about, articulating, defining strategies around what we need to accomplish. Gantt charts, maybe you are not in waterfall, and that's great, and you're in agile, and you've got backlogs. You made a face, but it's surprising how many folks are still working around in Gantt charts. You know, you've got like OKRs, you've got corporate strategy, whatever it looks like. It's all usually focused on what we need to accomplish. And we spend very little, if any, time thinking about how do we want to accomplish this? How do we want it to feel? And so the analogy here is, let's say you open up Google Maps and you have to go from here to your favorite restaurant. You type in your favorite restaurant. That's where you're going to go. That's the what. Right? Google's figured this out. Every other map app has figured it out. The first thing you're going to see when you plug this thing in is, well, how do you want to get there? Do you want to walk? Do you want to ride a bike? Do you want to take a car? If you're going to take a car, do you want to avoid tolls? Do you want to take the most economical route? The options are endless. And for some reason at work, we tend to think that there's like only a straight line path to the thing, right? There's infinitely many ways we could go from A to B. And so taking some time to think about how we're going to get there, both in ways that are best for our team and best for us, is really super important. And the reason why I think we aren't so great at this is because we don't take a lot of time to stop and think about it, and it's pretty hard. And so the exercise is like, how well do you know yourself? So we talked about Google Maps on your smartphone or whatever map app you want to use. The exercise you can do is get a piece of paper. You need a timer. You can use your phone if you want, but like a sand timer feels a lot more zen and feels like you're doing something different. But you're going to set a timer for 2 minutes. Take a piece of paper, start the timer, write out 10 things that your smartphone is really great at. Right? I use it to listen to music. I use it for maps. I use it for taking notes. Like, just what are all the things that you really think your smartphone's great at? Timer's going to tick out. And when the timer beeps, you're done. Great. Now what do we do? You flip your piece of paper over, reset the timer, hit start, write down 10 things you're really great at. I won't meet most folks that listen to the podcast, but I will gentlemanly bet you that you will have probably greater than 10 things in the what your phone is really great at. And in the version of what you're really great at, I'll be shocked if you get to 10. You will have less than 10, most likely, if you're like most people. If you get more than 10, great, great on you. And the challenge with this is, yeah, we spend a lot of time on our smartphones, but I spend a lot of time at work. Why don't I know what I'm really, really great at, disproportionately great at? Now, when you know this, once you know this, you have the kernel of a seed of, these are the things that I should be spending a lot of my time on. If you are phenomenal at breaking down really challenging technical problems, and that is what you really enjoy doing, how do we build your role around that?
Wonderful. Right?
And
wonderful.
So starting from this place of like, what am I already really, really great at? And how do you get that insight? So you can at least start with, well, where am I going from here? At least you know where here is.
Excellent. And I'm going to give a quick shout out to everybody who doesn't have making phone calls on either of their lists. You know, I had a cell phone since the late 90s. And since they became smartphones, making phone calls wasn't one of the things that I've used it for.
Fair enough. It's
on the regular. But yeah.
It's often down the list for sure.
Yeah. So the hardest part here is, as you were alluding to, sort of breaking from the assumption that everything is as it needs to be, and that all that I see is all there is to see, so that you can start putting things together in a new way that is a better tailored fit for you. How do you help people go about breaking those assumptions down, looking beyond what is just right in front of them, and allowing them to have that opportunity for growth, especially if they're in a more buttoned up organization?
Yeah. Again, I just challenging the assumptions is really important. It's hard for me to put a statistic against it, but I'm going to do it and I'll probably be wrong, but I don't know. It feels to like my experience is that somewhere on the order of 9 times out of 10, people are radically underestimating the agency that they have in their roles. And absolutely. And it takes courage for sure to have a conversation with your manager and say, hey, instead of doing it this way, I'd like to do it that way. Or instead of going in this direction, I'd like to go that direction. Or, hey, what would need to be true for me to try it this way instead of that way? It does take courage. You have to build up that muscle. But more often than not, I find that we don't even get started because we assume we have a lot less agency than we actually do. So really pressure testing the assumptions. And if most of your audience is technical in nature, like, the nice thing is this group of folks doesn't need any help thinking about how to break down and test assumptions, right? So putting these like career decisions, I guess, under the microscope in the same way you would, this is the feature we're going to build in this way and that way, and what are the, you know, pros, cons, whatever, whatever you want to do, like really breaking down the assumptions. Like, I'm assuming my boss will not let me X, and the organization can't afford for me to do Y, and we don't have somebody on the team who can do Z. Awesome. Now we have the assumptions down. Are these actually true? Like, let's go get some ground truth on those ones. More often than not, all of those will have wiggle room on them more than you think. At least one of them probably will. And then where I tend to start folks is 6 questions. If we were to just kind of pull the thread along of the mapping analogy here, I find that there's a lot of time and energy that I don't think is all that beneficial on average, which doesn't mean that it's not great for some people, because I think it is. But on average, there's a lot of time and energy on like professional development plans or whatever you want to call them. And I think the challenge with a plan, particularly if you're running an agile shop, it's just funny that like we've said, hey, agile is the best way for us to build product, and yet we're going to waterfall our careers. You know, that is tough for me to connect the dots on. And that's a hard thing to explain to somebody in sales. It's a much easier thing to explain to somebody who's in a technical role. And so I like to try to think about it much more as an agile approach of, you don't need a professional development plan. You need a compass. That's what we're looking for. Am I pointed in the right direction? What directions do I care about? Some of the outcomes are not going to go the way that I want. some unexpected things are going to come up. That's cool, right? But how do I just kind of define this compass and my point in the right direction? And so I like to get folks to think about 6 questions. What do you love doing? What are you really great at? What do you not love doing? What are you not great at? What do you want to improve on? What do you not want to improve on? Pretty simple.
Pretty simple.
Right. And then the compass is effectively, in my experience, if you want to really love what you do and enjoy what you do, you want to either do a thing that you love, or you want to leverage something you're already good at, or you want to learn something new, and you want to do less of all the things you said you don't want to do. And there's your compass, right? North, south, east, and west, right? South would be a lot less. East and west would be leverage and learn, and north would be love. It doesn't matter where you stick the compass points, but that's just the way that my brain kind of works them. And if you could take a little bit of time to just map these things out, what you can find is, okay, it's less about, like, the expression I like is, for some reason, I find we tend to think that a dream job is like winning the lottery, or we accomplish it. And I think it's a practice, right? Like, every day you practice your dream job. And if you're not practicing it, that's why you don't have your dream job. And so if you have this compass, then what you can do is you can take whatever thing you need to accomplish. And oftentimes we may not have agency about what we need to do, but you have a lot of agency on how you need to do it, right? Maybe your eng team is, the velocity is going way down. Folks aren't super happy and the quality of the code isn't where you want it to be. Okay, cool. Well, we have to solve that problem. That's the what. Now, if I'm somebody who really loves the leadership aspect and talking to people and figuring out what's going on for them, and Rob, you're a very analytical person, we're probably going to solve those two problems in very different ways. I'm going to take my compass and I'm going to decide, I'm going to go have one-on-ones with everybody on the team. I'm going to talk about what's going on. I'm going to listen to them, see what's happening in their lives. I'm going to pull the synthesis in that way. And Rob, you're going to take your compass, which, you know, for you, you love analytical stuff and you're really great at it and you want to learn that really new analytical tool, and you're going to pour through the numbers. Looks like when we work between these hours and those hours and get these spikes, this is what's coming out of it, and you're going to come up with a solution in that way. We're both going to, in theory, solve that problem, but our compasses, I was almost going to say compi, compasses, the compasses are going to take us down a different path to get there. And what I find is usually when I get someone to the point of, like, the light bulb has gone off, right? I didn't know enough of this stuff about myself. I had a plan, not a compass. Once I have the compass, at that point, the medicine goes down for itself. It's like, I know how to use this thing now. I know how to point myself at this thing. I don't have to change anything. It's not even a conversation with my boss. We're fully aligned that this thing is the thing to be working on. I'm just choosing to go about it in a way that I'm both better at and enjoy more along the process. So really shifting the mentality from, I need a plan, a professional development plan, a career development plan, to what's my compass and how am I going to use it to keep me pointed in the right direction day in and day out? You know, not trying to be super focused on where I'm going, just how am I getting there? What does that look like? And practice having a dream job.
And of course, regardless of whether you're the analytical or the people person, you're having routine one-on-ones with all of the members of your team.
That would be a good thing to do for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so you're having your conversations and you're looking at things that are, how do they align with what and where you want to be, how you want to accomplish that. And it's a lot of what we train folks on is how do you do exactly that, especially in the face of those assumptions. Once you barrel through the assumptions and you start going to next, the hard part then becomes having the conversations with the right people. So where do you step in for that?
You'd be a bit more specific. You mean if I was, well, I'm not, I don't know, I guess. Yeah.
Once I decide that I want to go from point A to point B, and I've worked through the assumptions that I can't get there from here, and I've figured out, you know, there must be a possible route, what comes next?
So somebody wants to get to a specific point. They don't see the path. They feel blocked. Like, what do we do? What do we do now? Yeah, this one's going to seem overly simple. And I do have maybe a one size fits all there, but like, you pretty much said the solution out loud. I think asking people, what do you think, is an incredibly beneficial question to ask. Now, the question is, who do you go and ask this? And if you don't know, I would just ask, I would just go. Like, who's sitting next to me right now? Can I talk to them? But this question of what do you think is really important. And I want to just break down the question, because I think there is a very common way that it's misinterpreted or misunderstood. There's a big difference between what do you think and what would you do? And there's a lot of times when we ask, what do you think? And I think because we're all humans and we really want to help each other, and it's just the way that we're all wired up, we hear the question, what would you do? And if I tell Jen what I would do, there's a very high probability I'm doing her a very unhelpful thing in that moment, because I'm coloring her situation with all of the background that I have about me and who I am and the kinds of things that are my compass and my life experiences. And I'm washing over all of that for her. And I'm doing it with the best of intentions. I probably don't even realize I'm doing it. But the challenge is that we don't have to go into all the behavioral economics and psychology and stuff, but because we're such social creatures, that if we can, if you want to, the moment that I hear what
of course
you
we want
do,
to.
The moment I hear what you would do, groupthink just kicks in. And, you know, I love talking to people about unconscious bias, and it took me so long to get my brain wrapped around this thing of like, no, dude, like, just because you know this thing exists, it still happens to you. Like, you can't stop it. It's not like it's being computed in the front of my brain where I see it happening. But the moment that I say to someone, I would do it this way, their brain either entirely or in some portion shifts from trying to like conform with the group and away from the rational analysis on their end. And so I really try to caution people against telling other people what they would do. When somebody asks you, what do you think, which is one of my favorite questions, what I think is incredibly helpful for people is, rather than telling Jen, let's say Jen was thinking about like, I don't know, I want to go become a VP eng at this company. Okay, great. She comes to me and she's like, I want to be VP eng here. I can't see the path. What do you think? Okay, version one is, well, Jen, here's what I would do. I would this, I would this, I would that, blah, 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 blah. Jen's probably sitting there. Hopefully, if we happen to be very similar people, she looks at that and she goes, man, that sounded great. I'm going to go do all that stuff. But what were the other paths that she could have taken? We don't know. More likely, Jen's going to hear that, and something on my map there for her is going to feel like, oh God, I can't do that. That doesn't feel right. That's not me. That's not my way. And I'm going to start showing up as not myself. And that's where it starts to get dangerous. On the flip side, rather than telling her what I would do, I can tell her what I would think. Jen, here's how I think about VP Eng at this company. These are the factors that I think are important. These are the skills that feel like they're important for that kind of a role here, right? And the difference is subtle, but I think it's quite important. I'm telling Jen the heuristics and mental models that I am using to think about the problem she's brought to me, which is going to add information to her. She could say, wait a minute, I wasn't thinking about the people leadership dynamic. That does feel really important. I should start thinking about what I was only thinking about my ability to, like, I don't know, run through burndown charts or whatever it might be. I'm adding stuff here for her where I'm giving her my thinking without telling her what to do, which means she gets the benefit of the data without the drawbacks of the bias coming in.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
I was going to say, we talk about that with two different concepts. Number one, if what you're describing is having your model of the world kind of come in and trounce the other person you're trying to help advise. And the way that we help people coach through that is we use a Star Trek metaphor. You beam down to their world, but as a member of the away team, you're not there to impose the Federation on whatever's going on. You're there to learn the local customs and the local stuff and advise in that capacity. So,
better than my lemon analogy.
It's close. I mean, we've been working on ours for a while. We didn't have to come up with it off the cuff.
I'll work on a Star Trek, somehow tie in through to Star Trek. But yeah, I think that's right. And you know, this is one of the ways where we talked about this earlier of, you just don't realize that you're doing this. You know, no, few people are out there saying, I really want to screw Jen up in this moment. What they're saying is, I'm going to help Jen. I'm thinking about this problem deeply. Here's what I would do. Right. But that is the thing that it really, really causes challenges for folks, mostly in my experience, because you don't even know that it's impacted your thinking in as big of ways as it actually has. So taking a hot second when somebody asks you, what do you think, to break your thinking down and explain to them how you're thinking about the problem, the factors you're considering about in the problem, the options that you're considering in the problem, is very, very helpful, because you're adding context to them that they wouldn't have if not for you, without biasing them with, well, it's easy, I would just do this, this, and that, and then look, you're going to be VP-ing. That's how I would be VP-ing, not necessarily how Jen's going to be VP-ing.
Yeah, I think, Jay, you're approaching a topic here that I know that, and I say approaching, it's like it's a huge topic, but it's like there's so much involved in it that I think that for so many of our potential clients, people listening, and even clients who we're currently working with, one of the main reasons that we see a lot of tech leaders stuck is because it's exactly what you said. It's because they didn't think that they can do it. Somebody told them they couldn't, and they're making all these assumptions that it's not possible. And somewhere along the way, they've forgotten that they've made an assumption. And it does a lot of times come down to, well, I asked this person, or even I asked this group of people, and they told me this is what they would do. Mm-hmm. And that's what they've been doing for months, years even, or decades. And then they end up on the phone with us and we say, well, why are you doing that? But really, why are you doing that? Well, because so-and-so told me, oh, wow, I completely gave up my agency. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think this is so important, because it comes back to this idea of agency that you brought up a few times, and I think is so pivotal. It's so pivotal. It's so central to the work that we do. It's so central to, I believe, part of the transformation that we've guided our clients to make is realizing that you have agency. You call it personal sovereignty, call it personal power, call it agency, whatever it is. It is my ability to choose, in this case, what my career looks like. Mm-hmm. So it's awesome that we're coming at it from different angles. Like with us, it's more one-on-one group coaching, and with you, it's more advising startups. That this from those different angles is, hey, you can decide here. You know, here's your permission slip. You can be the decider, and everyone's going to win in the process too. You're not going to stumble across it. And I think a huge piece in helping people to realize that they have this agency is essentially helping people to realize that they have this agency. This is a huge perspective shift. It's a huge mindset shift for lots of people. So how much work do you see this? I guess would be the first question.
Oh, yeah.
Is, you know, sort of making these shifts. And how much work do you do on sort of, whether it's an individual or a group level, in talking about whatever you might phrase it, changing mindset, changing perspective. In other words, it starts with you. And then we can start moving around the external stuff.
Yeah. Agree across the board. Uninteresting for folks listening, because we're not going to have a big massive disagreement about that point, but like agree across the board. And I think I spent a lot of time on this, you know, it kind of alluded to like the psychology and behavioral economics of this. Like I became a humongous nerd for like, what is going on in my brain? Why does it happen this way? Like how in control am I of, you know, that's probably a topic for another podcast, but there's a ton of great stuff out there if you want to read about all the different ways that we mess ourselves up, and we're very, very great at it. You know, the brain is just built in a lot of ways that makes us amazing at some things, and the side effects of that is not amazing at a lot of other things, and blinded to it in a lot of those situations. And so as I kind of think through how do we persuade someone is kind of what you just mentioned. The challenge that I see is I can only wave my hands in the air. People can't see me waving my hands in the air right now, but I can only wave my hands in the air so much. And in a lot of ways, I don't know a better term, and I don't mean this to feel condescending, which is going to make it sound this way now, I realize, but I'm going to stick with it. Like, I'll talk about myself just to keep it safe. Like, there are things I have to, you kind of have to learn them by doing. And no amount of somebody lecturing me on the thing will wake me up to the truth that they're trying to tell me. You have to show me. I got to do it. Right? You could tell me that I could work smarter, not harder. And I would say, no, I can't. I am smart. I'm working really hard. And I figured out all the ways to do this really well until I do something differently. And I see, and I'm like, aha, like proof is in the pudding, whatever expression you want there. Like, it's true. And so I really like talking to people about the high level philosophy, but capping it at a point. And I've spent a lot of my time and energy. And this is, I think, where a lot of the impetus for the book came from. If I could put myself in the shoes of my clients, is they seem to really like that I have somehow come up with a set of first steps. You know, I'd love the book to be a complete solution, but what I feel very confident it has is if you have problem X, do tactic Y and see what happens. And most of the time, it's going to solve that problem. And if it doesn't solve that problem, it's going to put you down the path to seeing that problem in a completely different way so you can solve it yourself. Right. And so we talked a lot about, okay, I don't have agency. And I used to spend a lot of my time and energy focused on how do I convince Jen that she has more agency than she does? Okay, I'm going to read a whole bunch of stuff on like neurolinguistics and the words I'm going to pick and how I'm going to structure my argument and blah, 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 blah. Great. That didn't work. Like, it's fun and nice and it maybe makes a little bit of progress. But if you have to change your mindset, your mentality, that's not like, this is firmware, right? This is not a small feature change. So yeah. Then I shifted a lot more of my focus onto like, I'm going to just show her. What can I help Jen do so she can see the results of this? And so if you're thinking about like the agency in your role, I'll give you one quick thing about what we talked about earlier. And then I'll tell you an anecdote about a thing I struggled with. Just to go back to like, if you ask somebody what they think, you mentioned a bunch of folks who went to a lot of people and they got feedback. It's like, you can't do this. And that set me down two mental paths that I think are really important. We're getting a real grab bag of tactics here. It's like we're shooting a shotgun and hopefully something's going to hit the target for folks. But the first thing is advice is dangerous, which is ironic for me to say in this moment because I guess I'm about to give some. So this is more of a like, think about this as a test or an experiment you can run rather than advice, which is really how I love to think about these things. And the dangerous thing is just unbridled, unconstrained advice is very challenging. And so we talked earlier about how, like, if I'm going to go to Rob and ask him, what do you think? He is naturally going to fill that space with what he would do. I can help him not do that to me. And the way I can help him not do that to me is by showing him what I think and then asking him what I've missed. So a really helpful thing that you can do before you go and ask people for career advice or any advice really is get your thinking out of your head. Right. So I really want to become the VP engine at this company. I think that means I've got to take on three mentors. I've got to manage four people and I've got to expand my capabilities in X, Y, and Z. Okay. Write it out. And I don't mean write a magnum opus. I mean, like, here are the Coles notes, couple of bullets. You know, you might start with 5 pages of written text and then you're going to summarize that down to these are the really salient features of this thing I'm thinking through. And then take it to Rob or whoever else you're getting feedback from. Hey, what do you think about this? What have I missed here? It's way easier for somebody to poke holes in your thinking when they see your thinking. If you don't give them your thinking, their natural reaction is going to be, well, here's what I would do. And as soon as I hear someone start saying that, I try to stop them right away. Like, super deep respect. Rob, I'm actually asking you a different question, right? What I'm asking you is, what have I not thought about here? What am I not considering? How would you think about this problem in a different way than I'm thinking about right now? Do you see it the same way as I do? If yes, why? If not, why? Whatever. So just a small change, you talk about it starts with you. It's really easy to blame Rob for telling me what he would do and that's his fault and now he screwed me up and groupthink and I'm in trouble and blah, 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 blah. I can do a thing there. I have agency and the agency is you got to show him or her or whoever you're talking to, I'm picking on Rob right now, share your thinking with them and get them to tell you what you're missing or what they're thinking about that you're not. That will help you much more often hear the things that will help you and avoid the things that are going to bias you in a way that's not so helpful. So really do take the time before you go get advice, like get your thinking out and ask people to critique the thinking. Side benefit, it's way more easy for people to critique thinking because they don't feel like they're beating you up. They're beating up an idea. It's much, 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 much easier, which is a side benefit there. But If you don't do that, and you can run this experiment, pick 10 people, come up with a problem you're thinking about, write out your thinking, show 5 people the thinking and ask them, you know, what they're thinking about that you're not, and ask the other 5 people, hey, what do you think? The 5 people you don't show your thinking to, they're going to start telling you what they would do. The 5
that
folks
would be a fun experiment.
To, they won't. Yeah. They're going to start telling you, hey, I would be thinking about this and I don't see that down here. Or this felt important to me and I don't see that you got that down anywhere. Or this thing here, you seem to think is very important. For me, this is like not a very important factor at all. Or I know this piece of information. I don't see that captured anywhere here. When people have that stuff to react to, it's much, much easier to jump onto the thinking rather than just filling it in with all of the best intentions with, well, if I was you, I would yada, 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 yada.
Yeah, I think that would be a really fun experiment. And I encourage people to do it. And I encourage people to really take a look at what are the results showing me beyond, because there's a lot to that experiment that you made that I'm seeing that maybe you're not, Jay, because it's why it's such an awesome experiment. Number one, or maybe you are, just I'm bringing it up because it's not in the context of what we're talking about. But like, yes, one of the things that you'll notice is that like, okay, if I show my thinking first, you're going to get way better feedback. I believe the other thing, here's the thing, is we're talking about seeking advice and seeking feedback here. The thing that I want people, that I want to persuade people to learn is that you should be very careful about who you're seeking feedback from. Because there's this tendency, I don't know if it's just in tech, although I have this feeling that there for some people, there's this like feedback culture and oh, I need to get feedback from 10 million different people. If you were to go ask 10 people, I think go ahead and do it, have the experience of it. One of the things that I'm huge on is, yep, we can build this mental model based on the science, based on what is logical to me. That's awesome. But then until we actually have the embodied experience of that mental model, in other words, until we take action on it, like you said, I can wave my hands all over and be like, be careful who you seek feedback from. If you go and you ask for career advice from 10 different people, my hope is that you will also realize you don't need to ask 10 different people. You just need to ask the one or the two who are experts and who actually already know, even though you asked, what do you think, right? They're not just gonna tell you what to do. And so it's an important piece of this conversation, I believe, because what I don't want to encourage people to do is go seeking feedback willy-nilly without agency. It brings back to that agency that we do actually always have agency. And we have agency in taking that action as well. So how do you feel about feedback is basically the question that I'm asking. So these are my thoughts. These are my feelings about feedback. I have it. It's kind of a love-hate relationship. If I'm being 100% honest, what is your approach and what are your thoughts and feelings about feedback, Jay?
Okay. So I feel like this is a like many branching. I can't wait to listen to this again and see all the different threads. And I'm excited that you're going to have to try to summarize it down at the end of the chat, but so overall, I think, on this one, we do have differing opinions, but I feel like it comes from a very similar place. You know, the challenge that I see is the reactivity to feedback, meaning because if I have feedback, then I must action it. I think it can be very challenging to hear feedback and make a conscious decision to not take action on it. And so for those reasons, I think I would agree with you that, okay, if you really struggle with that, shotgun blasting feedback all over the place and just like, let me collect 10 pieces of feedback from 10 different people. That could be very hard because finding the one nugget in there that's very helpful for you and that is going to drive you in the direction you want to go amongst 9 pieces of noise is going to be really very challenging. And I often work with folks who think, well, this person gave me feedback, therefore I have to do something about this. No, you don't, in my opinion. I feel very strongly that if somebody is going to take the time and energy to give me feedback, I do owe them something. What I owe them is to listen to make sure I understand and deeply consider the feedback that they're giving me. Right. And as long as I do that, I think I've met my end of the contract here. Jen's telling me something about a way I could improve or something I could do better. Or maybe she's even telling me, hopefully, something I've done really, really well. And maybe you want to do this stuff more, whatever it might be. That's great. I need to listen to that and make sure I understand it. It may or may not be the right thing for me to decide to lean into. And I get a lot of questions for people of like, well, just because Jen gave me the feedback, like who decides who's right? And as soon as that conversation comes up, I'm just like, well, hang on a second here. It's not about right or wrong, right? In my opinion, like Jen's going to share with me her experience, and her experience is her experience. It is irrefutable by me, right? So in my opinion, great feedback is, you know, people say, oh, you want to make it objective. I don't know what that means. I want it to be as subjective as humanly possible. When you did this, I felt this way. Right? I'm not telling you that you did your job wrong. I'm not telling you that that's not the right way to do it. There are certainly situations where we need to share that kind of stuff. That's different for me than feedback. I'm giving you like a performative, you know, advice or like a performance review of some kind. But you do a thing and, hey, Jen, that thing that you said, it really made me feel happy. It really made me feel pissed off at you. It really made me want to get up and walk out of the media. It really made me feel marginalized, whatever it might be. That was probably not your intention, unless it was to make me feel great, or hopefully you were trying to do that. But what I can't argue with you is that I did a thing that left you feeling a certain way. And so I'm a big fan of this like situation behavior impact model of feedback, right? SBI. And assuming people share it in that way, as I mentioned, like I think it's my job to listen to it. Then I take it and I say, what am I going to do with it? And particularly when it comes to career advice, you know, I'm a big advocate that just because someone did the thing before you and the thing that they did worked really well for them does not mean it's going to work really well for you. And that's why I find it's really, really helpful just to understand, like, what is Jen telling me right now? Well, if we were to use a specific example, I gave a presentation and she started talking and I talked right over top of her, right? And Jen comes to me and she says, hey, Jay, when you talked right over top of me in that meeting, it really made me feel like you don't care about my opinion at all. Okay, now I may choose to continue to talk on top of people for the rest of my career. And right or wrong, what I care about is that I do something like that with intent. What I can't argue is that Jen's point is 100% valid. I did a thing, she felt a certain way. Let me ask questions. Let me make sure that she understood it. I'd like to think that someone's not going to make the choice to intentionally walk on top of somebody else. You know, but perhaps it's a stand-up meeting where we've decided that one and only one person is going to talk. This sounds like a very ineffective meeting, right? But I'm trying to think of a situation where this would make sense. But again, the point is not that because Jen told me the thing, she's right, and therefore I have to do something about it. Because Jen told me the thing, she's right, and I have to consider on purpose, intentionally, if and how I'm going to change things going forward. And to tie the whole thing in one big, nice loop, you know, when folks work with me, when I was in operating roles, not advisory roles, people would regularly come with a decision that I had delegated to them, and they would want me to tell them what I would do. They wouldn't necessarily say it in that way, but they would be waiting for me to tell them what I would do. And we just talked about all the reasons why I don't think that's helpful, and it removes agency and it makes it harder and da 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 da. So I would regularly get feedback. Hey, you know, when I come to you with a decision, it would really make me feel better if you just told me what you would do rather than like not giving me that information. Great. At first I wavered on it, but the more I thought about it and the more I got this feedback, the more I realized this is a feature of the system that I'm trying to create, right? By not telling you what I'm going to do, you have to sit with the discomfort of this decision and figure it out for yourself, which is exactly what I want. And so I'm sure that they're right, that it felt more uncomfortable. I'm sure that they're right, that it would feel better for them in that moment if I just told them what I would do. And it doesn't fit with the leadership style that I have chosen, nor do I feel that it is, you know, hurting somebody's well-being. Therefore, their feedback is both right, and I consciously choose to continue to do things the way that I've been doing them. So that was a very long way to go around and say, you know, I hear your point. And for me, I think the pain point that I would poke on there is the difficulty of hearing feedback and not assuming you have to action it. And if you're in that camp, less feedback is probably going to feel a little bit better for you, because there's going to be less, let's call it noise, though I don't love that particular term, but.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And what I would say is, if you're someone like that, they, going back to agency, get to a place where you can receive feedback and filter out what's not useful, right? The way that I approach feedback is take what's useful, leave the rest without judgment, especially when it's unsolicited feedback. It's like, okay, cool. I get that you want to share your model of the world with me. That's wonderful. Thank you. Goodbye, basically. Right. Because we get questions all the time from clients who are like, my boss or my coworker, my colleague gave me this feedback. What do I do? You know, my colleague, my boss gave me this feedback that I don't communicate clearly enough. And we'll talk to them. And we'll also assess, okay, is this person a clear communicator? 9 times out of 10, they are. It's like, okay, and is this the only time that you've heard this? Yeah, it was. It was really just this one-time thing. So I'm just really not sure what to do. My boss told me that I'm not a clear communicator. You can take what's useful from that and leave the rest without judgment. Because first of all, did you ask for that feedback? No. That's not something that you decided that you actually even wanted to work on. But you can take and say, oh, maybe it is something that I want to work on. But again, I love the way that we're bringing back power and intention and agency here. So yeah, I think that feedback is important. And as long as it's done from a place of agency and power, both the seeking of it and the receiving of it, because we're going to receive unsolicited feedback. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's sort of filtering for yourself, what feedback do I want to seek? Because I think what some people do, just going back to the previous point, is they think they need loads and loads of data, when actually that's not necessary.
Yeah, I think
that,
like
that may not be the case.
No, I think I'm a test and learn guy. I'm like a one trick pony here, right? But I think the way I would think about your point there is what's my hypothesis? What's the job I'm trying to get done? You know, hey, if I don't know how I'm showing up for my team at all, maybe that's a good time to go and do a big cross section of feedback, because you really have no idea what's going on, right? I'm blind to what's happening here. I want to get a cross section and just see the feeling across 10 people, 15 people, whatever it might be. That's different than, hey, you know, my boss just told me that I don't really communicate very well. Okay, that's interesting. I'm going to go and try to see if this has legs. They brought it up. That's great. Okay, I'm going to go talk to one person. Right, I'm going to pick one person who's a really phenomenal communicator on my team and is in a lot of meetings with me. I'm going to tell them, hey, I'd love some feedback on my communication over the course of the next week. Can you just pay attention? I'm going to ask you on Friday, you know, if you have any feedback for me with respect to how I'm communicating. Right. So I think thinking up front about what are you trying to accomplish is a good thing to dictate. I completely agree. Like, you shouldn't always get 10 people and you probably don't always only want one. I think be very specific with, what am I trying to accomplish? And therefore, what's the test or what's the action that I'm going to take? And the one thing I'll just call out as positive from a situation that feels like, you know, doesn't feel great for some of your clients is, you know, I think a thing, past the feedback without judgment, but maybe the one thing I would lean on to help it feel a little bit better is be grateful that you have somehow been part of creating an environment where it felt okay for somebody to give you this feedback. There are a lot of people who are in the cone of silence all the time. Feedback is not flowing around. You might not enjoy hearing the feedback, but be grateful that you're at least in a position where your boss can come to you and say, hey, Jay, you stink at communicating. Now, hopefully they don't say it to you that way, but not a lot of folks have working relationships where that's something that is going on all the time. And I find, because I work with cross sections of team, you know, engineering teams are usually higher on this index of, yeah, we'll just share this stuff. It's better that way. Like, very pragmatic and it's awesome. Not a lot of teams are like this. You know, they're just not. And so when you get hit with a piece of feedback, it might not feel great. It might feel justified or not justified for you. I think always trying to keep in mind, always having a feeling of like, well, if nothing else, I'm grateful that this person felt comfortable enough with me to bring it to me. They trusted me enough to handle it like an adult, you know, and not, you know, freak out about it. And it might not feel like you're in a minority when you're getting feedback on a regular basis. You probably are. There's a lot of folks that maybe they get feedback in a performance review once a year. They might not even get that. So just trying to keep that in mind can be really helpful. So it feels positive in addition to the frustration that your boss thinks you don't speak well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It can feel really, gosh, so like such a lack of clarity and just this sense of like anxiety. I don't know how I'm doing. Not be saying anything. And that cannot be, can potentially be a situation that's really bad.
It also can get messy when your boss comes to you totally out of the blue. If I'm thinking about your situation, and why I like to keep gratitude in mind is there's a time and a place to react to that feedback. And it's probably not when the person's giving you the feedback, because there's, you know, nothing more corrosive to an environment of free flowing feedback than for Jen to tell me, hey, Jay, I don't think you're doing a great job communicating. And like my arms cross and my eyebrows go down. And I'm just like, here's 15 reasons why that is not true. And just like I'm processing the emotion in that particular situation. And so I really like the gratitude of like, wow, Jen's telling me this thing. Like, it's kind of catching me back here. Like, Jen, thank you for bringing me the feedback. I really appreciate it. Give me a hot second to like process this. You know, I'm going to just think about it and I'll circle back around later. But, you know, I just want you to know that I appreciate that you're bringing this to me, and thank you. Talk to you soon. You know, it can be super dangerous to just go straight down the, whoa, 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 whoa. I talked to 9 people about this last week. They all said I was awesome. You're wrong. My communication isn't, that might be the case, but it's probably not the moment to have that particular conversation. So I really like just keeping gratitude in the background at all times there. Sounds a little bit woo-woo-y, but it can be very, very helpful to just, okay, Jen's bringing me a thing. Thank you. I'm grateful that I'm in this kind of a situation. Thank you for taking the time to bring it to me, because it's not easy to tell people feedback, particularly when it's, you know, performative related. Thanks for doing that. And I'm under no obligation to tell you what I'm going to do about this right now in this moment. So I'm just going to say thank you very much, and I will think about it and get back to you.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And look, we love the woo-woo choo-choo. Bring it on. And what I would say is that there's some really fun, obviously there's research within psychology. Psychology is a science, folks. Let's remind everybody of that. And there's also in the hard sciences, in neuropsych and in neuroscience, there's more fun research. I'll let people dive down rabbit holes and listen to Andrew Huberman and others about that. But yeah, developing that gratitude is something that's really, really important to us and in our lives. And we pass that on to our clients, and we give them systems and strategies to develop what we call an emotional home of gratitude, so that no matter what happens, you can always find that. And it doesn't happen overnight. I think that disclaimer is important, that there is actually work that's involved in developing that emotional home of gratitude, that involves lots of different fun stuff that we don't necessarily have to dive down into. But if that's something that you want to do, maybe we'll do another podcast on that, and developing an emotional home of gratitude. But I love that you brought that up, Jay, because I think, you know, I think sometimes we might get too tactical, too practical, too much focused on the external and changing the external. If we don't focus on changing our own emotional home, our own mindset, our own identity, then it's like pushing a rock uphill. The external changes might happen, but then that magnetism is just going to keep coming back. Like if your emotional home is complaining, you're just going to keep coming back to that. So yeah, gratitude, so important. There's science behind it. Look it up if you listen. You know, if you're listening and you want to dive down that rabbit hole and convince yourself. But yeah, glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I'd give you an experiment there. If folks are listening again, and you want to just, I think reading about it is a great suggestion, and it really is unbelievable. You know, you read the benefits it has, and it reads like a drug, honestly, which is surprising. Like someone came up with a well-being drug. Turns out gratitude can do a lot of this for you. But again, we can talk about it till we're blue in the face. A thing I used to do, and I advise a lot of other folks leading companies to do, you can do it whether you're leading a company or not, set a 5-minute appointment with yourself, calendar appointment with yourself on Fridays. If you haven't said thank you to three people by the time you hit Friday, do it right then in those 5 minutes. Just send a really quick thank you to like, hey, thanks, Jen, in that meeting. It was really great when you did this and it clarified that. I really appreciated that. Thanks a ton. And, you know, hey, Rob, really awesome the way that you poked on that one ticket and it turned out that it was a major problem. And now we can go and figure out what to do about it. And to your point on it doesn't happen overnight. It's true. Absolutely. But you can start a thing pretty much right away. And, you know, I don't know when folks are going to listen to this, but presumably it may not be like Friday at the end of the day. So anytime that you're listening to this, you can actually do this week, right? Before you let yourself out of the office, force yourself to say thank you to three people and just see what happens. See how you feel rolling into your weekend after doing that 5-minute task, like either drop by their desk, pick up the phone and call them really quickly. Hey, I don't have a lot of time. I just really wanted to say this thing to you. Okay, cool. I got to go. Or hammer them a message on Slack or Teams or whatever it might be. And just see how you feel rolling into the weekend, doing that very, very small 5-minute practice. And again, I can't bet people face to face. Now I'm sounding like a real gambler, but like feel pretty confident making that bet that you're going to roll into your weekend feeling great. Not just because you did something that made you feel good, but because three other people, you're going to know that they feel awesome rolling into their weekends. And there's no better feeling than that. So very, very small bite-sized thing you can try out this week and you'll see that it will make a difference.
Yeah, that's a great, again, another great experiment, micro experiment. Let's call it that. It doesn't take a long time. And I love the dependent variable. I love the outcome there is how you feel. It's not what they said. It's not how they responded. Can't control that, right? They may not even respond at all. They may respond in a way that's awesome. That's great. Take it in. But the outcome that you're tracking there is how you're feeling. So that's great.
Do it five or 10 times and watch what happens to their impact. You know, that's the stuff that takes a little bit longer. Like that's a lagging indicator, but the leading indicator is how you feel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rob.
So we're talking about a lot of resources and a lot of things for people to learn. And one thing that I know a lot of folks in this area of our industry get into is analysis paralysis. So we want to thread the needle between inspired intelligent action and also learning about what would be the most intelligent action. When you're advising organizations, how are you striking that balance, Jay?
Yeah, this is a good one. Couple thoughts. It is almost always the amount of confidence that I need to make a decision is substantially lower than I actually like really ever thought that it was. And again, we go back to this idea of experimentation. And again, I am very big on it and I apologize to be a bit of a one-trick pony, but there are no shortages of decisions that need to be made in a business context. A very small handful of these decisions are mission critical. You know, you're going to like really cause a material problem for the business or somebody's well-being in your office. That's what I would classify as mission critical. Pretty much everything else is a blip, right? Yeah, we went this way. That wasn't quite right. Let's pull it back that way. No harm, no foul. Like, yes, it costs us some time, maybe some money, whatever. If you choose to take the time, or you can just read my book and trust me, but yeah, I feel free to take the time. You can experiment a ton with decision-making. And by this, I mean, you know, a lot of the science out there talks about how do you think about decision-making? How much information do you need to make it the most effective decision that you can? A lot of it talks about decision registries. Keep track of all the decisions that you made. A lot of technical teams love to do this. I find it to be very challenging. It's a lot of operational overhead. So not everybody likes to do this kind of stuff, though there is a lot of benefit. I had a period of time where I did keep a decision registry and the experiment I was running was exactly what you just described. I am going to get as much confidence as I possibly can in the decision. Then I'm going to track what happened over time. And on progressive decisions, I'm going to get progressively less confident. Less and less and less and less confidence. This is not statistically, scientifically rigorous. It is an N of one. working on a team with a bunch of people. The like variable we're testing here is my confidence, which is highly subjective. But you know, when the impact is as large as it is, the like precision of the test, I think, is a little bit less relevant. I would have thought that I needed to be, I don't know, 90, 85%. Maybe I squint and I'm 80% confident with stuff. Now, for most things, like below 50. And it's just because I think for me personally, I have a tendency to like downplay my confidence in a thing. I think I probably have more confidence than I tell myself that I do in a particular thing. And so I think analysis paralysis is a very real problem, particularly inside of businesses. And I think there's a specific case of analysis paralysis that is pretty painful for most folks, which we can talk about. And that's like, what happens to decision-making as you start to involve more folks in a team? So it feels like if I have to decide something on my own, I'm lightning quick, hopefully. Not all decisions am I this quick on. But as soon as I start to involve more people, it slows down and it gets potentially like grinding to a halt. Okay. McKinsey did an awesome survey. They did a survey of, it was like 1200, I think, managers, and they asked them to report on their time, of which decision-making was a certain portion of their time. And they asked them to self-report on how they're using their time inside of each of the buckets that they're self-reporting on. They were saying that they were wasting more than 50% of the time that they were spending on decision-making. It worked out to over 8 hours a week of wasted decision-making time, not decision-making time, of the time that they spend on decision-making, which I think was something like, it was 37, 38%. It was something like that. So a little bit more than a third of your time, a little bit more than a third of their time. Of that third of their time, roughly half of it is being completely and utterly wasted, 8 hours a week. So right there, you know, we talked about one of the first sections of my book was like, do 5 days of work in four. If you can find a way to more effectively make decisions as a team, you can get rid of that full day of wasted time. Not to mention, like, nothing kills morale faster than slower than necessary decision making. Right. So if we're wasting half of our time that we spend on decision making, that means that like we could decide something in a couple weeks and it's actually taking way over a month. And 2 weeks is already pretty slow to be making decisions. There's nothing worse. And I wish I could see people's hands in this moment, but I would ask people to raise their hands if this is happening to them. But how many times have you been in a meeting where we had to make a decision and the only decision we made at the end was when we were going to meet to talk about the decision some more? It's a classic thing. And so the number one problem, like if you're looking for a thing to accelerate your decision making, and you talked about analysis paralysis, the number one problem that I see that teams have is they don't actually know how they're going to make a decision. And when you don't know that, more always feels better. So if you take like one thing from decision making from this podcast, and you want a thing you can go and do, it's really easy to remember and it's super easy to implement. You can literally do it like take the headphones out of your ears and jump into whatever meeting is coming next. Before you debate any decision, first decide who's going to decide. That's it. And it is usually only in one of three ways. Version one, a human individual is going to decide. We're going to pick somebody. Version two, some portion or the entirety of the team is going to vote. Version three, consensus, which I do not recommend, but there are times when you might think that that's the right thing to do. Yeah, everyone's giving me the don't do it. But as far as I'm aware, those are the three ways that, you know, we tend to make decisions.
We can let an AI do it poorly.
I mean, that's delegating it to somebody. So it's, I guess it wouldn't be a human, you're right. So delegate it to an individual or entity of some kind. And so what this does is it lets us know what's going to happen when there's disagreement. And this is really important, because if you break down decision-making, what you realize, and this is very obvious, so I needed to break this down for myself. Maybe other people are smarter than me. When everybody agrees, it's really easy, right? When we all think that we should turn left instead of right, we don't sit around debating whether we should turn left instead of right. There might be red tape in your organization, but that's process stuff, right? But we turn left because everyone thinks we should turn left. When I think we should turn left and you think we should turn right, now we have a disagreement. And so the secret to faster decision-making is that the better we disagree, the faster we decide. And we can't disagree well if we don't know who's breaking the disagreement. So you talked about analysis paralysis. If Rob's making the decision, Rob tells us when he has enough information to decide. Full stop. He's like, okay, I've heard what I need to hear. I understand that Jay thinks we should go left and Jen thinks we should go right. I've heard what I need to hear. I'm going to go and make this decision. If we're taking a vote, we set a date for the vote. However much analysis we've done up until that moment is the amount of analysis we're going to do. We vote and we're done. Consensus is fuzzier. I don't recommend it. But if you choose that path, then you have to do as much analysis as you can, need to, until everybody on the team agrees with the thing. But at least this way, you know that you're not overanalyzing. So many teams forget this step because we all get so excited to like dive into the problem and figure out, you know, this is the, people will start saying, well, I would do this and I think we should decide that. And we talked about the dangers of that earlier, but we get right into the debate. You can do your team such a helpful thing by saying, hang on a sec, who is making this decision? And I'll bet in many cases, you'll get two or three hands. You might even have a situation where the decision maker is not even in the quote unquote room in the conversation at that moment in time. And you might feel like you're taking a step backwards. This is actually your first step forwards because you're going to debate who's making the decision. And as soon as that debate is over, you are now in a way better position to decide so much faster. And you just will avoid a lot of this unnecessary analysis paralysis because you have a way to break the disagreement.
Thanks for giving me this quick moment for our sponsor, Coverage Cat. We're very intentional about who we allow to sponsor the PeopleStack podcast. And when I connected with the folks at Coverage Cat, I quickly learned that they are an excellent fit as a sponsor. If you live in Washington, California, Texas, New York, or Florida, Coverage Cat is a free concierge service that will help you find the best price and coverage for your umbrella, car, home, and renter's insurance. And yes, loyal tech leader audience, we know that most of you need insurance, whether it's umbrella or other insurance to protect your wealth. We know how annoying dealing with insurance companies can be. So we love how Coverage Cat is making this process super easy. Fill out one form and they compare across dozens of carriers to find you the best coverage and price while you skip the spam and sales calls. Get your free optimized insurance quote today at coveragecat.com.
This is so, so important. Like, this is one of the things that we talk with our clients a lot. We've never said it quite so directly. And I love how concisely and directly you phrase this, Jason.
Write a book.
Decide who. Decide who. That's all you need. Because a lot of the times, like, clients will come to us with, let's call it like a promotion, a kind of a thing. Like, I want a promotion and I want to pitch this that I would like, and I believe I deserve a promotion. We have a whole process that we take them through in order to get to the point where they'd be pitching the fact that they believe that they deserve a promotion. And often at that point, especially when, actually, I'm just going to say it, often at that point, it's in lots of different contexts. The question, it's like, okay, well, what does the pitch look like? And what evidence am I bringing? And who do I talk to? And all of that. Hang on a second. Who are you pitching it to?
Yeah.
Are you pitching it to your boss or your boss's boss? Because that's an important question. Sometimes it's the former and sometimes it's the latter. And they're two different people. I don't care how much of a brain you think that they share. They're still different people. In other words, it's marketing. It's know your audience. And we can apply the same idea to decision making as well. That it's like, okay, you got to sell. Like, if it's Rob's making the decision and you feel really strongly that it should be this way, then you got to sell it to Rob. If it's more of a vote, I think it's still similar, right? It's like, I want people to, because I feel really strongly it should be this way. So I'm going to do whatever I can during our discussion and discussion phase of it, whether it's formal or informal, there usually is when there's some kind of a vote. I'm going to try to sell it. So this idea of selling and marketing, I think that this is really important here. You have to know who it is. If you don't, it ain't going to sell. So even just applying that, I just wanted to underline it because it's so, so important. And even just applying this one strategy, I think is just going to make so much of a difference for people. It's really
important. It's such a simple question and it is so often overlooked, you know, and it's so easy. Everyone can do it. You know, it's so easy to forget. And I think, yeah, if for sure, I can't tell you the number of times you talked about sales and I think that's different from some decision-making stuff in some ways that are important and probably a whole other podcast, but I cannot tell you the number of times I gave the best pitch ever to exactly the wrong person, or at least I thought it was the best pitch ever, but regardless of my thinking about it, like I just pitched somebody who had no decision rights on this thing. I thought they did because of their job title. And I failed to ask the question of, hey, like, do you sign this thing, you know, when we're done here? And I think for sure, if you're in a position where you're trying to push for a promotion, you're selling yourself. Yeah. Knowing who your audience is and who's making what decisions in what ways is super, super helpful. I think the one thing I would call out, and I know I could tell from the conversation, I'm sure you agree with this, but I'll just caveat it just to make sure, is I think it makes a ton of sense to sell yourself as much as you can when you're in a, you know, promotion situation. Hopefully you don't need to do too much of that because everyone around you has seen it. I think if we're trying to make the best decision possible about a work product or something like that, I think being very careful not to sell is really, really important. You know, I don't want people to buy me or my argument because I'm making the argument the best or the most passionately. I want it to be the best idea, right? And letting the best idea win, I think is an important thing to keep in mind. And that's why just making sure that you know, okay, who's going to make this decision? Because it doesn't matter how passionate I am about this thing, if it's Jen and not me, or if it's a vote, you know, I just think it's important to make sure that we don't run up in a political situation where, you know, we're trying to pit each other against each other in a decision-making setting that I think would be different in the situation you described of, hey, I'm really pitching for my promotion here. And in that case, guns a-blazing.
Yeah, I can tell that we have some alignment and I would just call it agree to disagree on certain things. Because I would say that you're always selling. And one of the things I think that is important is realizing that you're always selling. Now, I think the definition of selling, the definition of politics, that's something where it's like you can go down a whole rabbit hole of, you know, politics is nasty. Doesn't have to be. Selling is nasty, or selling always means that you have an inflated ego. I don't think that necessarily means to be. I think that even in the case where you have, it's an idea, you're still selling it, is what I would say. And I think it's really a different view of what sales is and what marketing is. And I think it's important for people to hear this, because I think for so many reasons, particularly folks in tech, are afraid of speaking up because they don't want to appear to be selling it. What we're saying is sell it, but do it with intention. Do it with compassion. Do it in a way where it's like, hey, yeah, I do love this idea. You know what I mean? And here's the reasons why I love this idea. So yeah, I think it's something that's really important for everybody to sort of come to terms with for themselves, that the conversation around sales and marketing can get really heated, I think exactly for these reasons. And I believe what we've brought to this, and hopefully in an intentional and compassionate way, as I just said, is that we can have very different definitions of what it looks like and very different approaches. And as long as, like you said in the beginning, which I loved, Jay, is that it's about the experience. What's the experience that I want to have along the way? And then here's the outcome with it. So yeah, sales is a tricky topic.
Sales, you mean make sure you speak up about what you believe in, 100% on board for that. You know, I think if people are sitting back saying, I don't want to speak up because I feel like it's going to be perceived as me selling a thing, I think find a different way then. But, you know, the answer isn't like, don't speak up. I think, you know, everybody is very focused, rightfully so, on building diverse teams. In my opinion, like how we should be thinking about diversity is about diversity of thought and what people bring to the table, which gets too often distilled down to what people look like or what their backgrounds are. And of course, those things are important. But, you know, if we don't speak up in meetings and we don't speak up in situations, then the fact that we have a diverse team by whatever metric we choose to measure, it kind of doesn't matter. Because the thinking that we want, the diversity that we're trying to get access to, winds up stuck in my head. It never comes out of my mouth for whatever reason. And so I think, you know, our stance might not be as far off as it might feel. I think the idea of speaking up, what I would probably say to folks is, yeah, if you're concerned that it's feeling like you're going to sell a thing, who can you talk to? What can you read? What can you think about? It sounds like you guys could work with them on this. Like, how can you find the right way for you to bring this up? And you know, I constantly get into these conversations about, oh, well, I'm very introverted, therefore I can't bring stuff up. I think on a great team, you know, you might be the kind of person who, you hear an idea in that moment, you have a quick twitch thought about it, and you stand up in front of your entire team and you deliver this like beautiful, passionate thing off the top of your head. It's perfectly coherent. You might be the kind of person who needs to think about that and write down a note and go home and go to sleep and wake up in the morning and take a shower and like grab a colleague for coffee and then write an email and send it to somebody on the team. Personally, I don't think it matters what the way is, so long as you find a way. Like keeping it in your head is, I think, where we really get into trouble. And so, or rather than get into trouble, like something gets taken from the team's not as good as it could otherwise be. And so for folks here that are leaders, I think a great point is, you know, how are you helping folks engage in the way that makes the most sense for them? Are you paying attention to, well, Jay's never really speaking up and I hear him in one-on-ones. He has a lot of great ideas, but they don't show up here. And, you know, have you thought through, okay, maybe we shouldn't, you know, bring up an issue and close it within 10 minutes. Like maybe we need for certain things to create enough space to let people think the thing over. So I'm constantly hearing from folks, you know, that's not my way. I'm not going to stand up and like deliver this perfect thing. I have to really, you know, mull over it and collect my thinking. That's great. You know, and I think your point, what resonated with me is, okay, we need to speak up, right? And you know, that it might come across the wrong way. You're only going to learn it by doing. Find your way. And I totally agree with find your way, speak up in your way, get your thinking into the team's collective consciousness. It will be better as a result, for sure.
Yeah, 100%. Rob, any final questions?
Well, I just want to say that whether we're talking about it as selling or as sharing our thoughts, we are always influencing because we are paid for our brains, first and foremost. As knowledge workers, we need to bring our knowledge to the fore. And if we don't, then it's not being useful. And as leaders, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that the people on our team have that space to do that. So I love that we got to this point of the discussion.
Yeah. And this has been a fabulous discussion, Jay. As you mentioned, we really peeled the layers back. We really dove into a whole bunch of different, very fun, very important. And I know topics that our audience will find valuable. So if people want to find out more about what you're up to, maybe they want to join your newsletter, find out when your book is going to be released, what's the best way to follow you and find out what you're doing?
Yeah, hopefully everybody made it through our long and winding conversation. It was great. I think we covered lots of stuff and very fun to get pushed around a little bit and have the ideas tested. It's really great. I enjoyed it a ton. So thank you. If this kind of stuff is interesting to folks, yeah, the best way is, so the book's called Quietly Crushing It, and the website is qcibook.com. So Q, quietly, C, crushing it, I, it, qcibook.com. If you go to qcibook.com, there's a place where you can sign up for my newsletter there. It's free. You'll get it every other week. I think it's pretty funny and it's full of really, really helpful tactics. And when you sign up, not only can you just unsubscribe anytime, but I'll send you a free preview kind of snapshot of the book. So you'll get a tactic that you can use that I've seen countless times do the whole 4 days of work or 5 days of work in four rather. And so you'll get that right away when you sign up for the newsletter. I really hope you don't, but if you sign up and get it and then unsubscribe right away, that's cool. At least you'll have a chance to read through it. But for folks that do sign up there, the newsletter comes out every other week, and that's the best way to get in touch with me. You can email me directly through that. I answer every email I get. They're super fun. People tell me what they like or top up on the ideas. I get a lot of people sending me terrible dad jokes or parent jokes that I cycle around into the mix, which is also really fun. And that'll be the best way to kind of get in touch with me, keep up with the tactics, and find out as the book's getting closer and closer and closer to launch.
Awesome. Well, we're excited for that. We'll be keeping an eye on that. And thank you so much for spending a couple of hours with us today. Thank you for spending valuable time sharing. Yeah.
I'm grateful for it. I appreciate it.
And that wraps up another episode of the People Stack Podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero. And it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs, aloha, and mahalo.